English Listening Comprehension Test, Autumn 2011, Advanced Level. This test is in five parts. Part 5 has separate directions. In Parts 1, 2, 3, and 4, you will answer the questions asked in the booklet by choosing the best alternative answer according to what you have heard. Mark each answer on the optical answer sheet. The test is about to begin. Now you will hear part one twice. First, listen to it straight through.
Good morning. This is Susan Bell. This morning I'm going to be interviewing the famous movie director James Cameron. James is well known for many movies, for example, the Terminator series and Titanic. But for several years now, all anyone has wanted to talk about is Avatar. That's because it was a rather entirely new type of movie. Welcome, James. We're pleased to have you here. My first question has to do with Avatar. Is Avatar a Native American story? Are we talking about what the rest of the world calls Indians?
Not entirely. I think Americans think about the story that way the most quickly. But Avatar was the number one movie in Brazil and was hugely popular in China. And that's because of the environmental issues. Governments there and elsewhere are displacing indigenous people from their homes and traditional places to live.
Will this new 3D technology completely change filmmaking?
People often ask me that, and I should pull their legs and say yes. But really, the simple answer is that filmmaking is not going to ever completely change. It's about storytelling. It's about humans playing humans. It's about those actors somehow saying the words and playing the moment in a way that gets in contact with the audience's hearts. I don't think that's changed in the last century.
So, if it hasn't changed, do you have a formula for creating a blockbuster film, James?
I have principles, not a formula. You create interesting characters. You put them in a story that has a number of dilemmas. Once you have the audience on the character's side, you put that character under suspicion. You try to create one or more emotional moments within a film, and you provide great visuals.
What was the most powerful motivator for writing Avatar?
For me, one powerful motivator was the opportunity to do a mega design project, design everything, the vehicles and the creatures and the plants and everything that's in front of the camera.
Well, to look at the other side of things, have you ever considered making a small budget film?
I've had a few projects over the years that have fallen by the wayside for various reasons. But frankly, I like to stick to big productions. I'm not particularly interested in doing a little film just for the sake of doing a little film.
How do you think the use of computer-generated images, CGI, and 3D will affect cinema?
Well, when we talk about the emotionality of computer-generated characters, there was obviously a milestone with Avatar that will have acceptance from here on. I think we're at an interesting stage where if we can imagine it, we can create it.
Before Avatar, you took a 12-year break in filmmaking. Do you intend to keep on working that way?
Well, I didn't plan on taking 12 years with that one. Things happen. But the enthusiasm and passion and the capability of the Avatar film team made me want to do more films like that. And quickly. You know, there's also an age thing here.
They say the filmmaking industry's in trouble. Is this because of the cost of the technology involved?
Indeed, the industry's in deep water. But that has nothing to do with the technology, nor is technology going to necessarily be the savior. 3D may help define the idea of the big show at the cinema, but I think the heart of the cinematic experience is the group experience. It's the psychology of sitting in a dark room with a bunch of people and reacting to something, and feeling like your reaction is the same as the rest of the group, a way of proof-checking your emotions are normal. If you're the only one out of 400 laughing, then maybe something's off.
And one last question. Why, after all, are your movies so long?
Well, Susan, I'd like to point out that Avatar was almost half an hour shorter than Titanic. So I'm improving. I've probably had more people ask me why Avatar was so short. You know, you have all that material, all that beautiful footage. You've been working on it, concentrating on every bit of it, every scene. Well, you know...
I think I know. And thank you so very much for this interview, James.
Now listen to the same interview in 5 sections. Look at questions 1 and 2.
Good morning. This is Susan Bell. This morning I'm going to be interviewing the famous movie director James Cameron. James is well known for many movies, for example, the Terminator series and Titanic. But for several years now, all anyone has wanted to talk about is Avatar. That's because it was a rather entirely new type of movie. Welcome, James. We're pleased to have you here. My first question has to do with Avatar. Is Avatar a Native American story? Are we talking about what the rest of the world calls Indians?
Not entirely. I think Americans think about the story that way the most quickly. But Avatar was the number one movie in Brazil and was hugely popular in China. And that's because of the environmental issues. Governments there and elsewhere are displacing indigenous people from their homes and traditional places to live.
Answer questions 1 and 2. Then look at questions 3 and 4.
Will this new 3D technology completely change filmmaking?
People often ask me that, and I should pull their legs and say yes. But really, the simple answer is that filmmaking is not going to ever completely change. It's about storytelling. It's about humans playing humans. It's about those actors somehow saying the words and playing the moment in a way that gets in contact with the audience's hearts. I don't think that's changed in the last century.
So, if it hasn't changed, do you have a formula for creating a blockbuster film, James?
I have principles, not a formula. You create interesting characters. You put them in a story that has a number of dilemmas. Once you have the audience on the character's side, you put that character under suspicion. You try to create one or more emotional moments within a film. And you provide great visuals.
Answer questions 3 and 4. Look at questions 5 and 6.
What was the most powerful motivator for writing Avatar?
For me, one powerful motivator was the opportunity to do a mega design project, design everything, the vehicles and the creatures and the plants and everything that's in front of the camera.
Well, to look at the other side of things, have you ever considered making a small budget film?
I've had a few projects over the years that have fallen by the wayside for various reasons. But frankly, I like to stick to big productions. I'm not particularly interested in doing a little film just for the sake of doing a little film.
Answer questions 5 and 6, then look at questions 7 and 8.
How do you think the use of computer-generated images, CGI, and 3D will affect cinema?
Well, when we talk about the emotionality of computer-generated characters, there was obviously a milestone with Avatar that will have acceptance from here on. I think we're at an interesting stage where if we can imagine it, we can create it.
Before Avatar, you took a 12-year break in filmmaking. Do you intend to keep on working that way?
Well, I didn't plan on taking 12 years with that one. Things happen. But the enthusiasm and passion and the capability of the Avatar film team made me want to do more films like that. And quickly. You know, there's also an age thing here.
Answer questions 7 and 8. Look at questions 9 and 10.
They say the filmmaking industry's in trouble. Is this because of the cost of the technology involved?
Indeed, the industry's in deep water. But that has nothing to do with the technology, nor is technology going to necessarily be the savior. 3D may help define the idea of the big show at the cinema, but I think the heart of the cinematic experience is the group experience. It's the psychology of sitting in a dark room with a bunch of people and reacting to something, and feeling like your reaction is the same as the rest of the group, a way of proof-checking your emotions are normal. If you're the only one out of 400 laughing, then maybe something's off.
And one last question. Why, after all, are your movies so long?
Well, Susan, I'd like to point out that Avatar was almost half an hour shorter than Titanic, so I'm improving. I've probably had more people ask me why Avatar was so short. You know, you have all that material, all that beautiful footage. You've been working on it, concentrating on every bit of it, every scene. Well, you know...
I think I know. And thank you so very much for this interview, James.
Answer questions 9 and 10. This is the second part of the test. You will hear this part twice. Listen to this part straight through.
The following is an interview by Stacey Billings of Stephen Gill.
Hello, Stephen. You've already been out with your camera since 7 a.m., but you've been looking at something quite unlike this studio, which is in an old warehouse in East London. We've got an urban view of tangled railway lines and, in the distance, the shiny towers of Canary Wharf. I understand you were on the hunt for a tawny owl and her owlets, which you'd spotted a few days earlier in a North London park.
Yes, I was out. You just have to really stare into the top branches and you see these balls of fluff. They're really camouflaged. I'm always aware nothing happens twice. So I checked the BBC weather and went back to see them, half knowing they wouldn't be there. But I like that idea of going there just to find out if they will be sitting in those branches again. Photography is so often about the pictures you don't take as the ones you do.
Well, what do you photograph besides birds?
Well, my photographs are often apparently of nothing in particular. I've taught myself to really step back and treat everything as equally important. I know that while photography is often seen as the amplification of something, it is also good at doing the opposite, quietening things and not enhancing them. And then perhaps you want to look at the picture or study it more.
I understand that through your own publishing firm, simply called Nobody, you produce and sell your photographs. Could you give an example of how this works?
Yes. One of my most complicated books was 44 Photographs, Trinidad, which I published last year. The entire book was manufactured and assembled by hand over a period of 4 weeks by a small production line of friends in my studio. The edition had 115 copies. It involved me and my team destroying a stack of vintage 1964 paperbacks I'd found at a flea market and then handwriting the title page. And each book is made from a scooped-out paperback. There were several other individual processes, including letter pressing and assembling the photographic prints into handmade pockets within the book. It's a work of art in itself.
Well, thanks for telling us a bit about your work, Stephen. It was a pleasure.
Now listen to the same discussion in three sections. Look at questions 11 and 12.
The following is an interview by Stacey Billings of Stephen Gill.
Hello, Stephen. You've already been out with your camera since 7 a.m., but you've been looking at something quite unlike this studio, which is in an old warehouse in East London. We've got an urban view of tangled railway lines and, in the distance, the shiny towers of Canary Wharf. I understand you were on the hunt for a tawny owl and her owlets, which you'd spotted a few days earlier in a North London park.
Yes, I was out. You just have to really stare into the top branches and you see these balls of fluff. They're really camouflaged. I'm always aware nothing happens twice. So I checked the BBC weather and went back to see them, half knowing they wouldn't be there. But I like that idea of going there just to find out if they will be sitting in those branches again. Photography is so often about the pictures you don't take as the ones you do.
Answer questions 11 and 12, then look at question 13.
Well, what do you photograph besides birds?
Well, my photographs are often apparently of nothing in particular. I've taught myself to really step back and treat everything as equally important. I know that while photography is often seen as the amplification of something, it is also good at doing the opposite, quietening things and not enhancing them. And then perhaps you want to look at the picture or study it more.
Answer question 13. Look at questions 14 and 15.
I understand that through your own publishing firm, simply called Nobody, you produce and sell your photographs. Could you give an example of how this works?
Yes. One of my most complicated books was 44 Photographs, Trinidad, which I published last year. The entire book was manufactured and assembled by hand over a period of 4 weeks by a small production line of friends in my studio. The edition had 115 copies. It involved me and my team destroying a stack of vintage 1964 paperbacks I'd found at a flea market and then handwriting the title page. And each book is made from a scooped-out paperback. There were several other individual processes, including letter pressing and assembling the photographic prints into handmade pockets within the book. It's a work of art in itself.
Well, thanks for telling us a bit about your work, Stephen. It was a pleasure.
Answer questions 14 and 15. This is the third part of the test. In this part, you will hear five short dialogues. You will hear each of them once only. Look at question 16.
Do you know what keeps the 1,500-year-old stone and brick buildings in good shape in China?
I think I've heard something about that.
You know, since the Ming Dynasty, sticky rice soup has been the key ingredient in an incredibly strong mortar recipe, which has kept ancient buildings intact to this day.
Yeah, that was it. I read about that.
Yeah, scientists have compared sticky rice mortar with traditional lime mortar, and the sticky rice rocks. It's also much better for withstanding earthquakes.
You don't say.
Answer question 16. Then look at question 17.
Have you heard about what's turned up in Indonesia? The census in Indonesia has found a woman who's 158 years old. She claims to have been born in 1853. That's when the Crimean War started, when Britannia ruled the waves. Just imagine!
Is there any reason to believe she's that old?
Well, there's no authentic data to prove her age, but judging from her statements and the age of her adopted daughter, who's now 108 years old, I guess we have to believe her.
Okay.
Answer question 17. Look at question 18.
I was reading about some little-known facts. Did you know that the earliest recorded case of a man giving up smoking was on April 5th, 1697?
What? When?
Johan Katsu, sheriff of Turku, Finland, gave up smoking. He wrote it in his diary. I quit smoking tobacco. I just can't breathe anymore. And he died a month later.
And what does that prove?
It's just something interesting. He must have had something.
Yeah, he must have.
Answer question 18, then look at question 19.
Have you heard that our vicar has revived an ancient law to call the members of her parish together for compulsory archery practice?
No, hadn't heard of that. Can she really do it?
Yes, she can. It's based on a custom from the Middle Ages. She can call all the men of the village to bring their bows and arrows along for some archery practice. She modernised it with a bar, a barbecue and live music, and included everyone in the parish.
Well, a fete is always welcome, but why this one?
Well, the Reverend Mary Edwards took a fancy to the idea when she found out about it. It's sufficiently bizarre that she wanted to have a go at it. And she's always admired ancient festivals, druids and all that sort of thing.
Answer question 19. Look at question 20.
Wasn't it interesting about the Dutchman who lost his camera? He was scuba diving in the Caribbean, and then he got it back, after it washed up in Florida, 1,100 miles away, and 6 months later.
Yeah, that sure was. And then the American who found it posted the pictures on it on a website and found the Dutch owner, within a matter of days.
Yeah, but the big thing is that a sea turtle mistook the camera for a meal and accidentally switched it on. That's really wild. The video's date is January, 2 months after the camera was lost. The Sea Turtle Finds Lost Camera video has been viewed over 1 million times on YouTube. That's fantastic.
Answer question 20. This is the fourth part of the test. In this part, you will hear 5 short dialogues. You will hear each of them once only. Look at question 21.
Have you noticed? For the last few days, John has been really critical of Susan.
Yeah, I have, and it's been bothering me. You know, I've been thinking about it.
Me too. What's going on? Why would he feel a need to put her down?
Answer question 21. Look at question 22.
Did you hear about the construction worker who had an amazing escape in China? He had fallen into a working concrete mixer.
A concrete mixer? How on earth did that happen?
Well, he was pouring cement into the mixer when the bag of cement got caught and dragged him into the machine. But luckily, a workmate heard his screams and ran to turn it off.
Was he hurt badly?
Answer question 22, then look at question 23.
Have you heard about Ken Wallace? He's a former James Bond stuntman. He's built an autogyro, a twin-propeller flying machine, all by himself. And he wants to reach a new record speed of 140 miles per hour. Would you believe he's 95 years old? He's been a pilot for 74 years.
Gosh, a James Bond stuntman, eh?
Yeah, he was in the film You Only Live Twice. But he's a really famous pilot and autogyro helicopter builder. And he's in fabulous condition. He flies every single day in any kind of weather.
And why does he want to set a new record?
Answer question 23. Look at question 24.
What happened downtown last night was just crazy and stupid.
I'll say. When those bank robbers tried to blast the front off a cash machine, they sure got more than they bargained for. They blew up the entire bank instead. And on top of that, they were forced to flee empty-handed.
Yeah, and the explosion was so loud it woke me up, as well as every policeman within 50 miles of here.
Woke me up, too. And I heard that it destroyed a couple of cars as well.
Answer question 24, then look at question 25.
China is light years ahead in railway development. They unveiled their flagship high-speed rail model, the 380A train, a while back, and it's able to keep up a faster average speed than any other train.
And how fast is that?
Well, like the name says, 380 kilometres per hour. So the train will offer a four-hour ride between Shanghai and Beijing. That cuts the trip time to less than a third of the driving time.
Well, it sounds as if the electric locomotive will transform society in the 21st century. That's just like what happened in earlier centuries, with coal-burning locomotives and petrol-burning cars.
Answer question 25. This is the fifth part of the test. It's a funny, ironic story. You will hear this twice. First, listen to this straight through.
We'll now hear Sam Brown talking about a young, vibrant man from New York City. His name is Michael Carson. And as you know, I'm not sure Sam Brown is entirely serious. He may well be trying to make fun of Mr. Carson.
Despite his humble beginnings, in a small five-bedroom, seven-bathroom apartment on the Upper East Side in New York City, local Manhattan boy Edward Michael Carson has made a success of himself downtown, as my sources reveal. It was only 6 years ago that Carson left his high-society neighborhood in the wealthy heart of New York City in order to become even wealthier in the city's banking district. Last week, he finally returned home. His closest neighbors recall when Carson was just a small boy, waiting in the marble foyer of their high-security, 40-story apartment complex each morning for a black stretch limousine to take him all the way up to the Dalton School, three blocks away. Carson chose to enroll at Columbia University, a decision that took him all the way across Central Park and into a scary new environment that he had never experienced before, except on occasional visits to the ballet and opera at the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. His professors remember that it was obvious right from the beginning that he would be successful. This was because he showed a willingness to do whatever was required, and you know what I mean, so that he could finish a course with at least a passing grade. And his grandfather, Samuel Carson, had made several million-dollar donations to Columbia University. So the professors felt they couldn't in all good conscience fail him. In 2004, Carson was fresh out of business school from the university. He was quite unsure what to do next. But he chose to leave the safe environment of home and try his luck in investment banking, a world in which he had no connections at all aside from one or two, well, maybe three, influential family friends in the business. With nothing in his pocket but the money his parents had put aside years ago, specifically to cover all of his expenses, Carson set out to make his own separate personal fortune as a Wall Street trader. According to Carson, many people he meets are surprised to learn that he is the product of a broken home, but his parents, Carolyn Layton, a psychiatrist, and Stephen Carson, a heart surgeon, divorced when he was only 18. Fortunately, they continued to provide him with unconditional support as well as nearly unlimited financial resources. After graduation, Carson traveled around Europe for a short year before returning to his studies and eventually earning an MBA. The big move came when he took up residence in an empty apartment owned by his dear Uncle Charles, a choice that ruffled the feathers of relatives who found the place wholly unsuitable for entertaining people of their social standing. Despite such obstacles, Carson never let his distant location limit his potential. In the past 3 years, he's married, made $100 million, and helped engineer the failure of a major Wall Street bank. On Friday, the proud family man said that he moved back to his parents' neighborhood on the Upper East Side because he wanted to give back to this neighborhood. It had given him so much, and to that end, he has donated $75,000 of his modest millions to the Guggenheim Art Museum. Carson remembers when he was growing up and his family had a maid come in only 3 times a week. And he recalls the lessons his parents and nanny taught him about hard work and determination, that they don't matter very much.
Now listen to the same story in 5 sections. After each section, you will have time to answer. Then you will go on to the next section. You will write in Finnish or Swedish. You must write your answers on the special answer sheet. Read question A. Question A. Listen to this and then answer the question.
We'll now hear Sam Brown talking about a young, vibrant man from New York City. His name is Michael Carson. And as you know, I'm not sure Sam Brown is entirely serious. He may well be trying to make fun of Mr. Carson.
Despite his humble beginnings in a small 5-bedroom, 7-bathroom apartment on the Upper East Side in New York City, local Manhattan boy Edward Michael Carson has made a success of himself downtown, as my sources reveal. It was only 6 years ago that Carson left his high society neighborhood in the wealthy heart of New York City in order to become even wealthier in the city's banking district. Last week, he finally returned home. His closest neighbors recall when Carson was just a small boy, waiting in the marble foyer of their high security 40-story apartment complex each morning for a black stretch limousine to take him all the way up to the Dalton School, 3 blocks away.
Read question B. Question B. Listen to this and then answer the question.
Carson chose to enroll at Columbia University, a decision that took him all the way across Central Park and into a scary new environment that he had never experienced before, except on occasional visits to the ballet and opera at the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. His professors remember that it was obvious right from the beginning that he would be successful. This was because he showed a willingness to do whatever was required, and you know what I mean, so that he could finish a course with at least a passing grade. And his grandfather, Samuel Carson, had made several million-dollar donations to Columbia University. So the professors felt they couldn't in all good conscience fail him.
Read question C. Question C. Listen to this and then answer the question.
In 2004, Carson was fresh out of business school from the university. He was quite unsure what to do next. But he chose to leave the safe environment of home and try his luck in investment banking, a world in which he had no connections at all aside from one or two, well, maybe three, influential family friends in the business. With nothing in his pocket but the money his parents had put aside years ago, specifically to cover all of his expenses, Carson set out to make his own separate personal fortune as a Wall Street trader. According to Carson, many people he meets are surprised to learn that he is the product of a broken home, but his parents, Carolyn Layton, a psychiatrist, and Stephen Carson, a heart surgeon, divorced when he was only 18. Fortunately, they continued to provide him with unconditional support as well as nearly unlimited financial resources.
Read question D. Question D. Listen to this and then answer the question.
After graduation, Carson traveled around Europe for a short year before returning to his studies and eventually earning an MBA. The big move came when he took up residence in an empty apartment owned by his dear Uncle Charles, a choice that ruffled the feathers of relatives who found the place wholly unsuitable for entertaining people of their social standing. Despite such obstacles, Carson never let his distant location limit his potential. In the past 3 years, he's married, made $100 million, and helped engineer the failure of a major Wall Street bank.
Read question E. Question E. Listen to this and then answer the question.
On Friday, the proud family man said that he moved back to his parents' neighborhood on the Upper East Side because he wanted to give back to this neighborhood. It had given him so much, and to that end, he has donated $75,000 of his modest millions to the Guggenheim Art Museum. Carson remembers when he was growing up and his family had a maid come in only 3 times a week. And he recalls the lessons his parents and nanny taught him about hard work and determination, that they don't matter very much.
This is the end of the test. You will now have 8 minutes in which to blacken with a pencil the ovals indicating your answers, and to check the written answers. Remember to make sure you have written the following information on your answer sheet: your name and number, and the name and number of your school. In addition, make sure that the information needed for the exam has been carefully marked in. Thank you.